In this second hour of Midday, we continue our conversation about the surge in Baltimore's inner-city violence and consider the public health issues related to the shootings. Dr. John Smarr of Sinai Hospital is back for another edition of Midday on Health. Also ahead, no antibiotics ever. That's the new tagline of Salisbury-based Purdue Chicken. What's the development about, and will Purdue poultry be less prone to infections? Also, a University of Maryland study links climate change, sweltering heat, and incessant rain to outbreaks of salmonella in Maryland's coastal communities. Midday on Health with Dr. John Smarr, after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday, everyone, our second hour. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. Later on in this hour, we'll have a conversation about salmonella, the food and waterborne bacteria. This is Midday on Health. Dr. John Smarr is with us, and that's one of our topics today. In a recent study, the University of Maryland School of Public Health tied extreme heat and precipitation, phenomena associated with climate change, to increased chances of salmonella infections and in a particular area, mostly affecting coastal regions, including Maryland's coastal region. This also comes at a time when the Eastern Shore's big name in poultry, Purdue, has been touting that more than half of their chickens have had no antibiotics ever. They've reached a milestone in the development of chicken without use of antibiotics. But also along the lines of that is the story of the avian flu, the price of eggs. We're going to get into all of that in this hour because it's all related in some way. Dr. John Smarr is with us again, an infectious disease expert from Sinai Hospital here in Baltimore. We talk about more than infectious diseases with John Smarr, but that's some of what we'll be talking about today. John, nice to see you again.
Yeah, wonderful to see you, Dan.
I just want to follow up to our last hour here, just because you're here, I just sort of irresistible to ask you about shootings, homicides, from a public health point of view. Mm-hmm. You know, we think about it in terms of law enforcement, but in terms of public health, this is a serious issue in Baltimore City. People are dying.
Right, and especially when you have anyone who has, now I'm in Sinai, so I'm not directly in the city, but you have people in the county and the city, and you're dealing with these overlapping populations. As anyone who's delivering care, doctors, other care providers, it's incumbent, I think, upon us to, especially if there are any red flags or concerns about how one's doing from a health standpoint, to possibly inquire about firearms in the home. That's one thing that's often talked about.
Have you
about.
Done that as a doctor?
I have. I mean, it's interesting because when we talk about doing that, a lot of the folks who are very interested in doing it are pediatricians, because they are not only trying to get a sense of the home and the environment that, say, if they meet a child for the first time that they're living in and being raised in, but natural topic is there a gun in the home? Thinking towards gun safety, does something else need to be done to protect the child from, let's say you have a gun and it's in an unsafe place or something that the child could easily access? But in a broader scope, every so often you run into people who, when they're dealing with severe emotional issues, depression, rage, bipolar disorder, all of these different things, it is very incumbent upon all care providers to ask questions about, you know, are you having, if you have a flag for it, are you having suicidal ideations? Are you having homicidal ideations? And in the context of that, I think it's very appropriate, because the whole thing, everyone knows, is whenever you're asking someone, are you feeling suicidal, do you have a plan? And then sort of asking what that plan is. And that intersects over to dealing with guns. And then when you're dealing with adolescent medicine, and you're overlapping more with current events and what we're seeing just in terms of people, preventable factors, that's not only looking out for the health of your patient, but also for the health of everyone
others.
Yeah,
yeah.
Globally.
You know, over the years, I've talked to police officers, detectives, social workers, doctors like yourself, pediatricians, other people in public health, epidemiologists, you know, and this question of mental health services that are available for people in low-income areas of this city and other cities. Because, by the way, the crime surge we're seeing, the violence surge that we're seeing here in Baltimore is going on in other cities as well. It's not just Baltimore. But they all of those people I just mentioned, even the cops, always raise this issue of what sort of health services are available to people, to kids as they're growing up in these environments where they see shootings. They grow up in this mm-hmm. environment of drug dealing, dysfunctional families, need mental health services, not available. Hopefully, maybe the expansion of Medicaid through the Affordable Care Act will address some of that. It's interesting to talk to John Smart just for a few minutes here about the homicides we're seeing in Baltimore, this increase in violence. Imagine, John, being in the hospital over the weekend where seven people who suffered gunshot wounds to their legs show up at one time mm-hmm. in a hospital looking for treatment because they've just come from some scene on a street where there's been a shooting, including one homicide.
Right. And you know, there are fewer things that would get my adrenaline pumping more in terms of just sort of anxiety, maybe, and being in that type of a situation. I haven't directly been in that to that number, but I have a couple of times during the course of my career in training be in situations where it's a smaller scale, like two or three people, but it's clearly clustered from the same event. And so in the short term, when you're dealing with people in the hospital, obviously the focus of care is to make sure that you deal with acute injuries, life-saving measures if needed, essentially fixing people up. But the bigger piece is then when you're transitioning, and I think this is what's harder and I would like to see more of a focus on, transitioning, okay, now these people have primary care doctors in the world outside. So how do you follow up after that? What types of psychological or emotional responses are you going to be dealing with, especially because it's one thing if someone, say, lives in a context or a culture in which this is a common thing that they see. But sometimes it's entirely a different thing if someone is a random shooting victim or even witnesses, which I've encountered several folks who just witnessing firsthand right in front of them gun violence. That's something that you, PTSD is one of the things you can bring up, other emotional issues that go to that. And how do you deal with that as a care provider? That's an interesting question. And it's made all the more hard by the fact, like you said, that with limited resources in many cases for mental health and for support, mm-hmm. that's a big deal.
I'm glad Dr. Stuart Varin called back. Dr. Stuart Varin called in the earlier hour. He's a child and adolescent psychiatrist, and I thought, well, maybe it'd be more appropriate to speak with him during this hour with you, Dr. Smar, for Midday on Health. Dr. Stuart Varin, V-A-R-O-N, is part-time faculty at Hopkins, and wanted to talk a little bit about the gun violence we're seeing in Baltimore now, and I guess with particular interest, its effect on children. So, Dr. Varin, thank you for calling the Midday Show.
Well, thank you for having me. You know, I was, at the moment, I'm in private practice, but from the mid-90s to the mid-2000s, I was in community psychiatry in Baltimore City and various, various jobs in Baltimore City schools, outpatient clinic, outreach into the city. We were in the East Baltimore, when I was at Hopkins, we were at the East Baltimore area. And back then, it was my concern, and still is, that the Baltimore City probably has an epidemic of PTSD in their kids. I mean, it was very common that, unfortunately, as part of my evaluation, I'd have to ask, have you ever seen somebody shot or stabbed? And many times, I would say in about 50%, it's not a hard and fast research data, but about 50% of kids either had direct observation or indirect through somebody they knew of that had had this exposure to violence. And my concern is, what is the access to care that these invisible, if you will, I mean, we hear about the people that are shot and the immediate family. I think the invisible victims are the children and families that get affected. you know, we have an EMS system that, you know, that is just remarkable here, trauma centers, et cetera. And as the doctor said, you know, they can fix lots of the physical things, you know, right there in the hospitals and follow-up physical therapy, et cetera. But I would imagine that the response from mental health aspect is probably not as accessible. And I would wonder whether there could be some development of a rapid response unit to children affected by trauma with the gun violence to at least make an initial assessment of how they're doing and their families are doing. But I would imagine also that there is a lack of funds, which is the reason why I transitioned from community psychiatry to private, because the clinics I worked in were constantly closing.
And I wonder, that's a great idea. I just wonder if there's anything like that in place. I know that a few years ago, the health department in Baltimore City was tracking young victims of shootings. That's different than what you're talking about. But I know that they were tracking young people who had been victims of shooting one time, which made them, targets a second time, likely to be shot a second time, according to all the evidence that's out there. So that was at least being done. But you're talking about, Dr. Varon, you're talking about the collateral damage. I'm sorry to use that term again, but that is what we're talking about.
Yes.
Dr. Smar.
Yeah, and I think one thing, and again, this is just more of a personal hunch than a data-based observation, but I think we're facing a challenge both in the milieu that is Baltimore, but even nationally, of a certain level of acceptance that this is a thing that happens. And unless that acceptance is turned, at least in some way, into more of a motivating, like, this is not acceptable, we need to do something about it, and getting the right people to say that who have the right money to lobby for the resources for something like the outstanding suggestion that Dr. Varon had. I don't want to sound too cynical or negative,
no,
but I think that's a challenge that we currently face.
We only in part mentioned guns here, but I mean, guns are available for people who want to evidently settle scores or, you know, need to enforce whatever they need to enforce or whatever. I mean, there are obviously a lot of guns around, so that temptation will always be there. I guess dealing at the personal level with people, trying to help people resolve their differences or their difficulties in life without a gun is the only answer, because the guns aren't going away, Dr. Varon.
Well, one thought, and by the way, in fairness to my colleagues at Hopkins in Maryland, which I haven't been as much in touch from a community mental health point of view, they may in fact have such a program, and it might be a very good show to have with those in the midst of community psychiatry today. I know investigators like Thief, who actually had a remarkable program in the mid-1990s, which is how I got to Baltimore, called these Baltimore Mental Health Partnership, which was collaboration amongst the highest levels of all the different services, and there may be remnants of that. But my wonder was, you know, with the guns, you know, can there be such a gun tax that would support programs of the mental health fallout after violence or leading up to potential violence? You know, we have that with some taxes on cigarettes. Which we couldn't ban cigarettes, but there are taxes on cigarettes to deal with the prevention efforts as well as the medical fallout of using cigarettes. Could we not have such a tax on guns? Now, I don't know if that's already in place, but that was another thought that I had to fund some of these programs. Because if you met much of the time, at least in the Baltimore and surrounding areas, the mental health system is sort of a two-tier system. There are those that can pay out of pocket, and then those that are under medical assistance. Those in the middle that have to use their insurance, unfortunately, at least with child psychiatrists and many psychiatric professionals, there's a dearth of them because of how insurances have covered docs. So many of them go out on fee for service. And so there is a lack of access to care, in part due to funding, unless you can pay for it yourself.
Thank you for calling in today, Dr. Varon, for your perspectives and a couple of good ideas there. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yep.
All right.
I'm glad you called in. Glad you called in.
Yeah, much appreciated.
I'd like to look into that, whether there is such a thing as a quick response unit like that. But he's right. This is a consequence of all this shooting that we don't always think about.
Right. And I sadly don't know the answer to whether or not something like that exists, but it's one of these things that's so obvious. For instance, someone, if you have a large enough type of a company, if you have a close coworker who dies, what's one of the responses that company does is they immediately have sort of, there's a grief counseling.
Right.
We don't use the terms rapid response, but immediately that's a thing to recognize that something like that is going to have potentially a profound emotional impact on people. And so extending that in a way to, as we were talking about, almost the silent victims, the people who they were not directly involved, but they witnessed this, and there's going to be harm potentially from that to them. Yeah.
I'll never forget this. I can't help but mention it because it's so vivid in my memory of an 8-year-old boy in Baltimore, and this is in the late 80s, early 90s. He had witnessed the killing of a brother, an older brother, near one of the old high-rise public housing projects. And by the time I got to this boy's house, he was eight years old, and he had been picked up by the police for holding drugs for drug dealers. They give a kid some drugs to hold for them. He also held a gun for them, you know, because if the cops stop the drug dealer,
right,
he doesn't have anything on him, right? So it was the day after his arrest, and it made news in the city because 8-year-old arrested for holding cocaine, right? And I'll never forget going to his house and seeing him in the backyard of this row house with what looked like a wad of newspaper crumpled up in his hand, and he was compressing it into a ball.
Mm-hmm.
And then his two hands split to the left and the right, and this wad of paper developed wings and flew away. It was a pigeon, and he was actually torturing the pigeon. He was crumbling it up in his hands. You know, there's all. I'll never forget this moment because it just showed so much anger. There were so many things wrong with that in
right.
that child. But that boy got out of that environment. He went into foster care. A family took him out to Carroll County. He lived and grew up in Carroll County. And the last time I checked with him, at the age of 25, he was doing fine. You know, he had a job. He was employed. He had his own home.
Mm-hmm.
His life had turned out pretty good despite all of that, but it was foster care. He had to get completely out of that environment for his life to change.
Right.
Anyway, I hope you don't mind me sharing that story.
That's fine.
Never forgotten that. Dr. John Smarr with us. This is Midday on Health. When we get back, we're going to change the subject here to, let's see, salmonella, avian flu, and Jim Perdue. And antibiotics and chicken. How's that? That'll be all.
That sounds great. That rhymed when you got up to the Perdue part. That's great.
That's all coming up in the next segment of our show. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday on Health. Dan Roderick's here with Dr. John Smarr from Sinai Hospital. He joins us once a month to talk about medicine and health in the news. So, John, I've got Perdue sharply cuts antibiotic use in chickens and has a new commercial out saying so and jabbing at the competition. That's a Maryland story. It's a national story.
Mm-hmm.
Bird flu threatens chicken and egg industries, the avian flu causing the price of eggs to go up. And study ties heat and precipitation to rise in salmonella infections in Maryland. This is a study out of the University of Maryland Public Health School. So let's see. These are all sort of connected.
That's true.
Do you mind if I start with salmonella?
Let's start with salmonella.
Yeah, always associate
great.
Salmonella with chicken and eggs.
Yes.
Although it's associated with all kinds of things. This is a study that says that salmonella infections are associated with things that we attribute to climate change, extreme weather, extreme heat, incessant rainfall, lots of precipitation, and mostly in coastal areas. Let's go over what the study says.
That's right. Absolutely. And so hopefully we'll be able to get the link out. It turns out I was able to track down the study. Is the whole thing's online if anybody wants to read it.
Oh.
And it's also.
So you want us to put a link up?
Yes.
Yeah,
so
we'll do that.
So we
okay.
can do that. Absolutely. But essentially what this group did at the University of Maryland is they had this interesting question of there have been other studies that have been smaller scale trying to figure out if issues with weather and climate change, does that have something to do with, say, the growth of different bacteria that could cause problems for humans like Salmonella can? But there hasn't been anyone who's done a lengthy study to look at that in terms of looking back at a large number of records. So essentially what they did was, over a 10-year period, they went to a database where called the Maryland Foodborne Diseases Active Surveillance Network. There are no sexy names for any of these. But this is something that's been set up by the CDC. It's actually one of 10 of its type across the nation that is trying to surveil for a certain number of diseases that are potentially bacteria that could affect humans. And they looked at this for 10 years to figure out, well, from what areas in Maryland are we seeing a lot of infections in people with Salmonella? They then went back and looked at the weather for the same period of time, by which they had a bunch of different metrics they were looking at, including temperature, moisture, precipitation. And they also went back further than that in terms of the weather to make sure they had a good baseline. So they actually had 30 years or so of data before this 10-year period they were looking at.
To demonstrate that in the 10-year period, if there was anything different, they'd have something to base it against.
Exactly, so that they can have a true fluctuation if they saw that. Mm-hmm. And essentially, there's a nice graph that's in the paper. They've got some statistics that are very easy to read. But they did see that when they had temperature events, they came up with these definitions for an extreme temperature event as well as an extreme precipitation event. And they found that if there was an increase in an extreme temperature event, there was an increase in the amount of Salmonella infections during the same time period that occurred in people. And specifically, the most profound thing is this was mostly concentrated along the coastal areas of the state. And they talked about several reasons why they suspect that might be the case. And if, as you might imagine, if you're dealing with extreme temperature, extreme precipitation, you're going to have more violent weather potentially on the coasts. You have the potential for flooding. And how is that going to affect, say, sewage deposition? Things are going to get into the rainwater.
Farm animals.
Right. And
manure.
Right, exactly.
Right?
So you're going to have
a big problem.
Runoff
from farms.
Exactly.
Is that okay?
Yeah. And so that's all.
So that would affect people living in a coastal area because of the water saturation?
Water saturation, flooding, those were some of the things that, in terms of coastal flooding as opposed to more inland.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea then is that if the temperature, if the climate change is such that it's warmer, it's moister, and these are the types of things that may promote Salmonella to grow more rapidly, the combination of all of these things means there's a greater risk for human beings to be exposed to it, and so therefore more infections.
When you talk about more infections, what kind of numbers are we talking about here?
Well, they saw during this 10-year period, again, this is per this registry, it was just under 10,000 total.
In Maryland?
In Maryland, but reported to this specific place. 10,000 total cases of salmonellosis, which for the most part was infectious diarrhea.
Yeah. Stomach flu, cramps.
Yes.
Lots of unpleasantness.
Vomiting, yes.
Can Salmonella be fatal?
It can be. Now, currently, especially in the U.S., the mortality is less than 1%. It is not a common fatal illness. However, it is a very common debilitating illness, and you can think about it, again, from a population standpoint, because this type of thing, especially if it's in kids, and kids and the elderly are the most vulnerable populations to this. Just imagine one child in daycare gets this, and then you easy spread among other children, among families.
I understand that how extreme precipitation or incessant rain can contribute to the spread of, this airborne bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
Airborne, waterborne, whatever it is.
Waterborne,
right? Waterborne would be the case. Okay. What about heat? How does heat contribute to it?
Exactly. So essentially you're talking about you have a generally higher temperature with a higher humidity, and these are the types of things that many bacteria, including Salmonella, if they're out and they're able to grow and they've got enough of a food source, they're going to grow and make more copies of itself, so there's more Salmonella to go around.
So it might be nice to live near the water or waterfront over there on the eastern shore or someplace, but this might be one of the hazards that you'll face in the future, especially if there's a farm nearby, right? Which there often is.
Yeah, exactly. And there was an interesting, because they did the background statistics on population in here, which I was not aware of, but they were pointing out, and one of the reasons this is important to them, they said two things, that overall in the U.S., people are moving more to live on the coast. They said there was an 84% increase over the last 50 to 60 years across the U.S. of population on coastal areas, and specifically on the eastern shore, the population of people living on the eastern shore is supposed to go up by about 30% by the year 2040. So it's not just that it's this population, it's this population is also growing. And so with this in the context of climate change, this is something that we need to pay attention to.
One other thing about salmonella. Remember when salmonella was showing up in California spinach a few years ago?
Oh, yeah.
This can happen, right? I mean, it gets into the ground soil. It gets into the ground and gets into the plants.
Yes. I was very, right? my personal story about that is that my local pizza place I ate at had a spinach bacon pizza that was outstanding, and then they stopped the spinach. They wouldn't make the pizza, and this was for months, and it was—
You see how it can affect your life.
Such a minor frustration, but—
Midday on Health with Dr. John Smar. Our phone number, 410-662-8780, if you have any comments or questions for Dr. Smar during this hour. Okay, so now I'm going to move over to Jim Perdue and Perdue Chicken Operation based in Salisbury here. We had a New York Times story over the weekend saying that Perdue had reached the no antibiotics ever level for its chickens. It took Perdue roughly a decade to perfect the raising of chickens without antibiotics of any kind, and now it has reached a tipping point. This is what's being reported in the Times. More than half of the chicken it sells can be labeled no antibiotics ever, a first for a major poultry company. Competitors such as Tyson and Foster Farms are moving to eliminate the use of antibiotics important to humans from their chicken operations as customers such as McDonald's and Chick-fil-A demand it. So, John, I want to talk about this a little bit here because we have the avian flu story right next to it, all right? Bird flu threatens chickens. Perdue boasting about not having any antibiotics in its chickens anymore, reaching this tipping point. So in fact, Mr. Perdue is out with a commercial,
yes,
telling people about this and taking a bit of a jab, I think, at the competitors.
Some of my competitors say that in a few years they'll stop using antibiotics used by humans. But what are you having for dinner tonight? And what if you want chicken raised without any antibiotics? Two answers: Perdue Simply Smart and Harvestland. Two trusted Perdue brands with one thing in common: chicken raised with no antibiotics ever. Don't be fooled. If it doesn't say this, you might not be getting what you think.
Okay, he mentioned the Harvestland brand there. That's a reference to a brand that Perdue started about a decade ago in an attempt to eliminate antibiotics. And these products require this labeling antibiotic-free under the Harvestland brand. Antibiotics have long been used in the diets of farm animals to promote growth, control illness, and reduce costs. This has been a controversy for a long time. We recently did a show about hogs being raised without antibiotics in Denmark. All the farmers in Denmark who raised pigs decided no more antibiotics. I forget how many years ago that is. So what do you want to say about this story? And then here's the avian flu story I keep holding up right next to it, John. So
we'll get there. Yes.
All right.
So it's really interesting, and I know we've talked before about the consequences, like the rationale behind why antibiotics are used in feed animals to begin with, are that they are ostensibly keeping them healthier, and also we know that maybe independent from that, you get more bulk. Animals tend to be larger when you put antimicrobials into the feedstocks. But the flip side of that is it comes at a potential cost in terms of there have been ties to antibiotic resistance, antibiotic-resistant bacteria, antibiotic-resistant salmonella maybe, and Other potential issues, there's this loose epidemiological tie to potentially human obesity and what that might mean to and gut microbes and things like that. But it's something that is agreed, especially for a resistant standpoint, for resistant bugs that could cause human infections. That's a big deal. Now, I think it's very interesting in their marketing, and this is something that I don't want to misstate, is there when they say no antibiotics ever, they mean specifically they're saying all antibiotics. But keep in mind that when you read that other statement that just describing the competitors, they said antibiotics commonly used in humans.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that. What does that mean, antibiotics? Are there antibiotics not used in human medicine?
Yes, and there are. They are antibiotic molecules. So any molecule, any chemical structure that has the ability to kill bacteria is an antibiotic. And of course, there are different types that are used in humans. But there are some types, particularly this one group that are called ionophores, that are a type of molecule that have never been used in humans. They haven't really been studied for that. You can't actually prescribe someone that. You can't go and take them yourself. But they are used commonly
in chickens,
in cows, cattle, pigs, those types of things. And so the idea is that, and this has been not extensively studied, which is interesting, but there are a couple of studies that have looked to say, all right, is there a detrimental effect if animals that we are going to eat are given these antibiotics that are not routinely used in humans? And at least the relatively speaking small data that we have suggest no, that there does not appear to be an effect on, say, drug-resistant bacteria or human health from these other antibiotics. But it's to me, it still remains somewhat of an unanswered question definitively. And so when they are saying no antibiotics ever, my understanding, and I may be wrong, but my understanding is they mean even these ionophores, everything else that they are not using, at least in these products that are labeled no antibiotics ever.
Well, let's see what this Times story says. The Times story says Tyson and Foster Farms are moving to eliminate the use of antibiotics important to humans. They continue, however, to use ionophores, antibiotics not used in humans.
Right.
A point Purdue is trying to hammer home in new ads featuring Jim Purdue. So Purdue is saying he's gone past all this now.
Right, right.
He actually has a whole class of chickens that don't have any of this.
Correct.
Okay. So now I move over to avian flu.
Yes.
Okay.
The next threat to the chickens.
Yeah. All right. So you eliminate antibiotics. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that chickens are given antibiotics is to control illness, right?
Mm-hmm.
As you say, it promotes growth.
Mm-hmm.
But what about controlling illness? So is this is the downside of it? There's more avian flu. There's 48 million birds, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, accounting for 11% of the nation's egg-laying hens, have been slaughtered for fear of infection during the past few months, driving up the cost of eggs. Well, eggs are still a pretty good buy. Even
right.
If they double in price, they're a good buy. But anyway, so John, what is the consequence? Is this a consequence of not using antibiotics in poultry?
No, it's not, because, I mean, it's a different thing. We're talking about viruses versus
Thank you.
Bacteria, and so it's
you're going to walk Dan through these things sometimes.
Yeah, no, that's perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. Happy to hold your hand and go down this disgusting infectious lane with you.
It's lovely.
So bacteria, so we're talking about a different class of these microscopic bugs that can cause diseases, and things like antibiotics work against bacteria. In some cases, we do have medications, antivirals, that work against viruses. Like, for instance, Tamiflu is an antiviral to treat influenza in
people.
Do
chickens don't get those?
I do not believe.
They don't give them flu shots?
No. Right. But there are vaccines that are typically stockpiled for human use potentially, but and if you think about it, the rationale is because, unfortunately, the animals, chickens, live, their lifespan is so short that the idea of doing something like that to give, say, a vaccine when they're the right age before they're actually eaten, it's not a practical thing, at least in most cases, to even think about. Right. But the challenge is we've got such this huge, ponderous machine that is the food production system, to get people chicken, to get people eggs, is very common conveniences. And so to get to that place, you have these large farms, production areas that you have thousands and thousands and thousands of chickens that are constantly being grown so that we can use them for food. And as with any public health thing, if you have a crowded population of creatures, people, whoever, and something like the flu
gets in there,
strain of avian flu gets in there, then that's going to be potentially devastating. And so the rationale behind, you see these numbers about how many chickens are being killed off, and it sounds, it's huge, it sounds horrible, but the reason is because they're concerned that they've been exposed and far more chickens could actually be infected. At least that's the rationale behind doing that, if they're not able to control the infection. And at many cases, the decision is made that's the best way to control the infection in a chicken population.
The opening paragraph of the story on Purdue in the New York Times says that the hatchery number 3 in Salisbury, Maryland, is spotless. The floors are spotless. Doors have been rehung to open out. And temperature control and ventilation systems have been upgraded, all to minimize the potential for airborne contamination.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good thing.
Yes,
sounds like
absolutely
a good thing.
Absolutely.
John Smarr is with us. Midday on Health. Dr. John Smarr is with us for the remainder of the hour. If you have any comments or questions about what you've heard so far, please give us a ring at 410-662-8780. The Midday email address is midday@wypr.org. A couple more things to talk about when we get back. HIV in young people rising in Maryland. Scratching our heads over that. And a hepatitis C drug that's actually pretty great, except the price is amazing. So no one can afford it. Anyway, more with John Smarr when we get back. Very excellent lunch today, delivered by Rosina Gourmet. Rosina Gourmet has served handmade, locally sourced ingredients for their sandwiches, soups, salads, and vegetarian items since 1999. They're located in Canton, downtown Baltimore, in Harbor East. Now back to our very appetizing discussion
about chicken,
bacteria, and flu with Dr. John Smarr. Hey, John, before we go any further, you just took a quick look at the Purdue website.
Yeah,
on that question of ionophores.
Yes,
ionophores. So
exactly.
They don't have ionophores.
So their statement is essentially, so their goal with this promotion is that greater than 50% of the chicken they sell, they will be able to label as no antibiotics ever. And if it carries that label, they're saying that none of these ionophores, no antibiotics used in humans, nothing. However, on their chicken that does not have that label, they still will potentially be using ionophores in those chicken populations. So it's good to know that nothing apparently means nothing, at least for what they're stating for this ad campaign.
It's impressive. But who checks on them? Who checks on Purdue?
I believe
to make
that's
sure
the,
this isn't happening.
Would that be the FDA or the USDA?
One of those
regulatory bodies, yeah.
Hey, Ann in Ellicott City wrote in an email to make a point here, asking John to please make clear the difference between antibiotics used to treat an actual disease in cattle, such as mastitis in dairy cattle, and antibiotics used as a preventative measure. Dairy cows develop mastitis just as humans do. They are treated with antibiotics, and that milk does not, she says, go into the milk tank until the infection clears up. Humans get mastitis too, and I don't think any mother who has ever experienced it could begrudge the control of the disease.
That is very true, and I appreciate that clarification, because when we've been talking about this issue, we're talking about antibiotics that are generally put into the feedstock, again, with the outcome goal of having healthier, larger animals. But what she's also pointing out is that if an animal has an infection, like a cow has mastitis, it's a difference to actually give them antibiotics to treat that active infection. And that's not the issue that we're talking about here. We're not talking about antibiotics used to treat an animal that might have an infection, but antibiotics that's put in the food of all animals as a general course.
John, we're going to move on to HIV now. This is a troubling headline, and then you read the story and you scratch your head over what's going on here. HIV in young people rising in Maryland. Among those newly diagnosed with HIV statewide, the proportion of those ages 20 to 29 nearly doubled from 16% in 2003 to 31% in 2012. the proportion of infected teenagers increased at about the same pace. The situation in Maryland reflects what is happening around the country, and if the trend is not reversed, it could yield tragic consequences, according to health officials. This is a story in the Baltimore Sun from last month.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about this before, and overall, though, HIV diagnoses have decreased, right?
Right, right.
It's just that we're seeing growth in particular age groups.
Well, this is, when people look at this statistic, I think that it's important to recognize that that threatens, sort of, if this becomes a longer-term trend, that could threaten the comment you just made,
yeah,
that maybe we're finally making headway,
yeah,
and we're having a decrease in the number of HIV diagnoses. And I'm sure from a national level, I think we all heard, I think it was a few weeks ago, that the governor of Indiana declared a state of emergency in Indiana specifically because there were areas of Indiana, more rural areas, where there were huge outbreaks of HIV that were occurring. And so some of the factors, and pulling it back to Maryland especially, that we're looking at, I think it can probably boil it down to two things. One is, as we've talked about before, we have a younger generation of just adolescents in general, but a younger generation of people who were not around in the heyday of this terrifying new disease, and especially with its association with the risk factor of especially young men who have sex with men, that they don't have that same level of
fear,
anxiety, yeah,
mm-hmm,
about even whether or not they could get the infection. But separately, our drugs in some ways now are so good in terms of, you know, 15, 20 years ago, the idea of taking medication for HIV, that's where that phrase, the HIV cocktail, comes from, is that you need multiple drugs, but you would have so many different pills that you would have to take multiple times a day, and they would have so many bad side effects. And nowadays, we actually, on the market currently in the U.S., we've got four one-pill, once-a-day combinations, several of which don't have a lot of common side effects. So a lot of people can take them and they don't even feel like they're having any side effect from their medication. And so I think part of it, too, is that some people think, you know, if I get it, there's an easy treatment for it.
Yeah.
Even with the idea of knowing intellectually maybe that this is a lifelong thing, we're not talking about a cure. But the other thing that's concerning too plays into something else, which is the idea of prescription drug abuse. And that's where in some of the discussions about why is HIV popping up in these rural areas, it seems that one factor is people get hooked on something like oxycodone, other narcotics, other prescription drugs, and then maybe their supply dries up. They're not able to get them, and they're jumping over to using heroin or other injectable things for the first time.
Can be easier to get and even cheaper.
Precisely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the flip side of that, too, is you've got a group of people who may not be, for lack of a better phrase, used to the idea of injecting drugs. And so the idea of doing such a unfortunate habit safely in terms of not sharing needles, exposure to blood, things like that, is at a higher risk. And so that could be another factor, just this absolute, not under using the word epidemic in some areas of the country, including ours, with prescription drug abuse, opioid abuse, is something playing into it.
Can you be infected and not even know it for quite a while?
Yes, and that's one of the issues.
Delaying treatment.
Right. So you can get the HIV infection, and it could be years before
there's
a medical reason that you may come to the attention of a doctor or end up getting tested for it beyond just getting screened. A lot of times when people first get the infection, you feel sick to some degree, but that's not 100% true, and that always passes away. And so most people who have that feel like, oh, maybe I had a cold or maybe I had the flu. And then you feel fine for years and years. And meanwhile, in your body, at some point, the HIV virus it infects these certain cells in your immune system, and it eats away at these cells. And at some point, you get to the point where your body can't fight off infections that are actually strange and wacky infections, let alone regular infections that everyone gets. But in terms of these stranger infections, these are things that people with normal immune system, you never have to worry about because your body takes care of those.
What is recommended for testing?
Well, testing, we have within the last year, there's been a new test that's come out just in terms of the technology that's behind it that is good enough and has a combination test in it that you can do this one test and it's very, very reliable. It used to be that we would do a blood test that would give us the antibodies, and if that was positive, though, we didn't necessarily believe it 100%, and so that would be repeated. We would run a different test called a Western blot that was a confirmatory test. So you've probably heard that phrase before.
Yeah. From you on this show.
Yes, exactly. But now this new test actually does not require this Western blot for confirmation. And so it's, again, it's an easy, quick screening blood test. And we also now are living in an era where you can get over-the-counter testing at a pharmacy that doesn't actually require interaction with someone else. It used to, we've had for years, blood testing or HIV testing. You go to the pharmacy, you'd get it, but you would then do the test yourself, but then you would make a phone call, and then a courier from this company would pick it up, and then they would talk to you over the phone about the results. But now there is a more of a public availability of being able to do a rapid test yourself without having to interact with someone else, which, of course, to many people would be a barrier to being tested in the first place.
So a couple of things there. It seems that in terms of public education, especially to young people, the message is going to be it can still be a terminal illness. It's not just a chronic disease, right?
Well, it's a chronic disease.
It is a chronic disease, but I mean...
But there's a big but, and that is that, you know, the one thing is that key to its management, key to not having problems with it in the future, is being able to get on treatment and sticking with treatment And right now, the answer is indefinitely for the rest of your life.
And the other thing is, I guess the teenagers always have especially teenagers, have a problem with the risk thing. I know this is risky, but it doesn't really change my behavior.
Right, especially if it's not going to make you feel deathly ill right away. That's one thing. The other thing that we've come to know more and more about HIV over the last 10 or 15 years is the fact that there are other consequences of just having the infection. Like it can rate, and it's separate from the infectious stuff, especially if you're not treated. You are at an increased risk for heart attacks, for strokes, for kidney problems. And when you get on treatment, that's something that can also be prevented. But there is still going to be a little bit greater risk than if you never got HIV in the first place for some of these issues, even some types of cancers like lymphoma. And again, you're talking about these intangible things that may happen 20, 30 years down the road. And so that's a challenging argument sometimes for a young person who sees other people and may know people with HIV who are taking this medicine who seem perfectly fine to understand and to maybe incorporate.
How about $84,000 for a standard course of Sovaldi? You know what that is?
Oh, I know what that is.
That's the hepatitis C dream drug, right?
Yes.
$84,000 or $1,000 a day, according to this story.
It's I can't even come up with words. And, you know, we're in this amazing time period for hepatitis C. I'm actually treating people for hepatitis C.
3 million people in the U.S., according to this story.
And so there are multiple drugs, and their price point is all similar. And it turns out that we can get them, most people, if you have a prescription plan. But it's a prior authorization progress. There's all this paperwork. There's this specific lab testing we have to go through in order to be able to convince most prescription plans to cover these medications.
Because it's so expensive.
Because it's so expensive, yeah.
I mean, there are other medications besides this one, Sovaldi, that I just quoted at $84,000.
Yes, and they're all similar, and they all, for the time being, have similar price points. Because that's what the going market is. And the theory is that maybe the companies are pricing these at this level because hepatitis C is something that we should be able to cure and eliminate from the human population.
Tainted needles, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tainted needles, what else causes it?
Potentially sexual encounters, but the bigger driver is things like exposure to blood.
Yeah.
Needles, things like that. Yeah. It's so there are wonderful drugs that work so much better with less side effects than the previous ones, but this price point is ridiculous.
It's ridiculous.
But, you know, it's something that we've been able to successfully get for people.
You know, I'm going to hang on to this because maybe
we can talk more. We should talk more about
this. Do this another day. Mm-hmm. The cost of pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
John Smart, who is based at Sinai Hospital, joins us once a month for Midday on Health. Nice to have you back on the show, John.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, everybody. Have a great afternoon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Samantha Max, Beatrix Lockwood, and Max Bookdahl. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.